everybody. This is Janice, and I'm back with the Cambridge University Law Society podcast. I was going to say I'm back by popular demand, but I fear that might be a bit of a mischaracterization. So let's just go with I'm back. Anyway, in today's episode, I'm joined by Alistair Mills, and we spoke a little bit about his new book, The Law and Practice of Human Rights. We met up in his office at Magdalen. It was a very lovely and cozy place, and I'm very grateful for him for inviting me to speak to him, and I had a really good time. It's currently Halloween, so happy Halloween to those of you that celebrate, and I hope you've all got exciting, scary costumes lined up. And if that's not your vibe, options abound. Scary movie nights with friends, a cozy lion. All right, anyway, enough with the dawdling. I'm going to get straight into it. I hope everyone enjoys this episode. Yeah, I hope everyone's doing all right. It's 9 a.m. on Halloween, so thank you for braving this early start. And on the topic of braving things, today we're going into an area of law that's attracted quite a bit of scrutiny, especially recently. Hopefully this conversation will be a little bit less scary than the day suggests, and there's no foreshadowing here. So your new book, The Law and Practice of Human Rights, provides what is described as a thorough yet usable guide to human rights law and practice. It's written by a team of experts at Landmark Chambers, and it explores both the legal frameworks under the European Convention of Human Rights and the enduring role of common rights law in protecting rights and liberties. To start us off, what inspired you and your colleagues to write this book, and what gap did you feel needed filling in the current conversation about human rights law and practice?
Well, thank you so much, and good morning. The honest answer in terms of writing this book is that it's a practitioner book, a book which sort of seeks to set out what the law is rather than so much what it should be. And there are excellent practitioner books in terms of UK human rights law, but they are very old now. As anyone listening to this will know, that any legal book gets quite out of date very swiftly. And once you're looking at a book which is, you know, 10 years old or so, its utility really drops. And so our idea was to publish a book which is up to date, which is comprehensive, which is useful. And therefore, we felt it filled a gap in the market. And we hope it'll be useful for people wanting to know really what human rights law, both in Strasbourg and in the UK, is now. So that was the main objective. We do have a bit of setting the law in context in terms of its history and its international context, but in large part it is explaining what the Human Rights Act does, what the European Convention rights are, and how you'd seek to go about enforcing them in a court.
That's amazing. Okay, so could you tell us a bit about the history of the Human Rights Act, how it came to be and what it was trying to achieve at the time, and how do you think its role and perception has evolved over the past quarter of a century since it came into force?
Okay, so I suppose in some ways the history of the Human Rights Act is very lengthy, in that we can go back into the distant past and think about the history of sort of civil liberties in the common law. So Entick and Carrington, for instance, which in some ways is a case about privacy, case with the king's officers going into someone's house and going through his papers, etc. And there are quite secure common law rights in terms of fair trial and fair process. So that is part of the legal history of the Human Rights Act. But then, as part more of the sort of wider context, a major part of the history is essentially World War II and the rise of authoritarianism both before and after World War II, and the European Convention viewed as some sort of defence, some sort of conceptual defence against communism, the idea that there are some rights which the West view as important, maybe in contradistinction to the ideas of communist socialism in the East. And so this gave rise to the Council of Europe and the signing of the European Convention and the UK's signing of the European Convention, and indeed the UK's role, substantial role in drafting the document. But although individual litigants in the UK had the right of individual petition, they could bring cases before the Strasbourg court, the sense grew and grew that it was insufficient, that you had to go to a foreign court ultimately to enforce these rights. And so, to use a well-known phrase, the Labour Party in opposition sought to bring these rights home through the Human Rights Act, which it essentially developed while in opposition. Ways, and in some ways that is part of the important context of the Human Rights Act, that in some ways it was a political distinction between the Labour and Conservative parties in the 1990s, and it was part of Labour's vision for government in Tony Blair's first administration, and indeed it was a fairly early piece of legislation to be passed in 1998. And one of its main roles, and indeed its main effects, has been to reduce the number of cases in which the UK is found to be in breach before the Strasbourg court, because it is possible to enforce those rights in UK courts rather than having to go to Strasbourg for that. So in terms of how things have changed in the last 25 years, we might come to that a bit more later, I suppose, but essentially the Act has been really quite successful in that regard. The UK is its rate of default, as found by the European Court for Human Rights, is now very low, and the Human Rights Act, I think we could say, has been successful in reaching that objective.
Okay, great. Would you say that the origin of rights is more kind of in the procedural side of things? So things like habeas corpus, you know, as you said, fair procedures and fair trials.
Yeah.
And has that evolved recently in terms of protecting more substantive rights?
Mm. So in terms of the common law, I would completely agree with that the common law is pretty good at securing some form of rights. So making things like a court, the common law is good at doing that fair process and, you know, the rights of the accused. The common law does that fairly well. Things which the common law does not do well are possibly what we might view as more substantive notions. So things which are protected in Article 8, for instance. I know I referred to Entick and Carrington, but that's a bit of an outlier. Essentially, the common law is very poor at dealing with things like privacy. An example of that is the Malone case, Malone and the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, a case from the late 70s. It was held at common law that there was nothing to prevent the police tapping your phone so they could. And that is quite typical of the common law. That was nothing to do with the right to fair process. There might have been a fair process right as to the extent to which that could be used. You know, that might interest a common law court, but, you know, nothing said they couldn't do it, so they could. You know, that of course would have been, and indeed was held to be, completely unlawful as a matter of the convention by Strasbourg. So we can see the different sort of things which the common law protects.
Yeah, okay. So we're talking a little bit more about public bodies and the powers that they have, and how that can sometimes violate individual human rights. Mm. Action against these public bodies is done through judicial review. So would you say that the HRA's integration into judicial review and administrative law has been successful? Or have the boundaries between public law and rights-based adjudication been blurred?
I mean, it's a really good question. I think that it's generally been successful. And the reason for, it's generally been successful sort of on a constitutional level. And the reason for that is that although the Human Rights Act is trying to sort of bring in European convention rights, it does so very much using UK or English tools and within that context. So one of the main tools which the Human Rights Act uses is that of interpretation in Section 3. And interpretation is something which a court is very used to dealing with. You know, judges do that all the time. And so making use of the tool but making it a bit more muscular is what Section 3 did. Unsurprising, that has worked really fairly smoothly. In terms of the sort of constitutional setting, the Human Rights Act was drafted so as to attempt to basically protect rights as much as possible without infringing on the principle of parliamentary sovereignty. And that is what Labour said it was trying to do. And again, it's been fairly successful in doing that in terms of Section 4. In terms of administrative law, again, the Human Rights Act uses fairly conventional ideas of administrative law. Section 6 is about quashing unlawful administrative decisions. That is essentially what much of judicial review is about. Okay, it sets up some new standards which are different to what would have been the case before the Human Rights Act. But this is a tool which is familiar, again, with a carve-out for parliamentary sovereignty. So it's fairly familiar terms for the courts to be operating in. That there are, of course, some points of tension, which I think is inevitable in something as ambitious as the Human Rights Act. So in Article 6, in relation to administrative law, there remains an uneasy area of law in relation to the requirement that an administrative decision maker has to be independent, and the difficulties which arise when, say, a decision maker decides whether they have to pay out a benefit, for instance. You know, how are they independent? And that has caused quite a lot of problems over the years. We are still getting a sense of where proportionality fits in UK administrative law. That is, you know, even this year, there was an important case on that, the Schwidler case. So that is something which there's still some uncertainty. I think partly because for claimants, it seems like such an attractive form of argument that there'll always be the temptation for claimants and maybe certain, you know, for judges to receive such arguments, to really push the envelope there. But overall, I would say that given the ambition of the Human Rights Act, it has been very successful in terms of fitting in to conceptual frameworks relatively comfortably.
Yeah. So you talked a bit about proportionality there, and that's quite a big idea in law in general, both domestically and internationally. How has the UK's approach towards developing kind of proportional review in human rights compared to the international scene?
I mean, in terms of international law beyond the European Convention, I'm not particularly well placed to comment on that in terms of my own focus. In terms of proportionality as between the UK and Strasbourg, I mean, the general message is that the UK has sought to follow largely what Strasbourg does in that regard. Now, that has been more or less conservative as time goes on. As in any area of law, but particularly in one which relates to the powers of the state, one does sometimes see a pendulum swing to and fro in terms of how intensive the court's review will be from time to time. But in terms of proportionality, I suppose one of the more important cases recently would be the Ellen Kane case, really reinforcing the role of the margin of appreciation in domestic law, saying, you know, if Strasbourg would say this, we're not going to find this to be disproportionate because it is within the margin of appreciation, then according to UK law, it is not a breach, and therefore, you know, the action will be unlawful according to domestic human rights law. And so in terms of regulating the relationship between UK and Strasbourg in terms of proportionality, that is a reinforcing that the UK really shouldn't be rushing ahead of Strasbourg. And I think that was quite an important development, albeit a conservative development, if that's not a contradiction in terms.
Circling back to the idea of human rights law in practice, as mentioned, the book was written by practitioners, and one of its strengths is showing how rights play out in legal practice. What's your view on how the HRA comes into play for practitioners? And are there areas of law that the HRA reaches into more frequently than others, and maybe even more unexpectedly?
Thank you. That's really worth thinking about, because for my part, I think public law gets really interesting, not when we just think about general principles in the abstract, but when we roll our sleeves up and think, how do these principles apply in specific contexts? Because their applications can be very different. Anyway, to actually answer your question, when I was doing pupillage as a barrister many, many years ago, one of my pupil supervisors said, there isn't really such a thing as a human rights practitioner. That's a bit like saying, I'm an expert in civil procedure. You know, you will just have cases which raise human rights in a whole swathe of cases, in the same way as, you know, the civil procedure rules come up in basically all civil cases. And so human rights affects a really wide range of questions. Basically, it's potentially relevant to almost any relationship which somebody has with the state. And so there are realms where human rights, the relevance of human rights is very obvious and comes up an awful lot. Immigration is the most obvious one of these. But a very large number of immigration cases which litigate will raise human rights issues one way or the other. Likewise, issues relating to mental health and detention of individuals under those powers. But right at the other end of the conceptual spectrum. You can see human rights arguments being very important in tax law, for instance. So there is a whole swathe. Yes, immigration raises human rights more than tax law does, I would expect. But that's not to say that any practitioner whose work touches on the state isn't going to have some awareness of human rights and human rights principles and human rights procedure as well.
Could you speak a little bit about how the concept of standing operates in HRA claims and whether the rules on who can bring a claim are well understood, or are they perhaps too restrictive in some ways?
Thank you. This is a really good point, which links on to the last thing I was saying about, you know, everyone being a human rights practitioner in some ways. Because the problem is that people might assume that standing is the same as between, you know, normal administrative law and human rights law. So Section 31 of the Senior Courts Act, you know, the sufficient interest phrase, and a fairly liberal test of standing in general domestic judicial review. But under Section 7 of the Human Rights Act, the test is the victim test. You yourself have to be a victim of breach of human rights. So that is a very narrow test of standing. Basically, you have to be the person who's suffering the breach. There are some exceptions to that, usually relating to a situation where the victim cannot speak for themselves, quite commonly in Article 2 cases when they're no longer alive. And that test of standing is not always seemingly remembered by practitioners, maybe for whom human rights is not a major part of their practice. I'm thinking of a fairly recent planning law case in which the local authority was bringing enforcement action, saying that you cannot use a certain building for residential use anymore. And the owner of the building sought to challenge that, including on Article 8 grounds, saying this is interference with the rights of the home. And, I mean, the Article 8 argument was not strong for a number of reasons, but the judge also said, well, you own the building, but you don't live there. You're a company, and you're not one of you're not one of the tenants of this company who's actually living here. So you're not a victim. You can't bring this argument. And there's no sense in which the people who do live there would be prevented from arguing their Article 8 on their own. And so this point just can't get off the ground. And if memory serves, it was the judge who raised that. So it just seems that standing had not been thought about or recognised quite as much as it might have been. And so, as I say, this is a reminder that human rights principles and human rights practice can be relevant to basically anyone whose caseload involves the relationship with the state.
Mm-hmm. All right, so going back to more kind of procedural things, remedies for human rights law are described as one of the most unsettled parts of the law. Do you want to speak a little bit about what exactly the different tensions are in the law at the moment, and are there different conflicting principles when it comes to rewarding remedies?
Thanks so much. So one of the things which is unusual to an English lawyer in terms of remedies in human rights is that quite commonly the Strasbourg court will say, yes, there has been a breach of this right, but us finding there has been a breach of the right is sufficient in terms of a remedy. Now, that doesn't fit particularly well with an English lawyer's conception of what happens when a right is breached. But I think we've got fairly used to that now. I mean, in terms of remedies under the Human Rights Act, one of the most important ones is Section 6, which is that if there's been a breach, or if a public authority has acted contrary to human rights, then their decision will be unlawful. And, you know, that would lead to a quashing order, and that's fairly straightforward. What gets more tricky for English courts is damages. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the Strasbourg court will award damages, and that is unusual for English law, because generally you don't get damages for breach of public law principles. You know, in a judicial review claim, if you're saying that that a decision has been made which is Wednesbury unreasonable, you're seeking for that decision to be quashed. You're not seeking to get money to compensate you for the Wednesbury unreasonableness. And so that was something of a novelty for the UK courts. And one of the first questions which they had to answer is, okay, well, if we are giving damages, how do we calculate them? Or what are the principles on which they are calculated? One measure of, one possible approach of doing this is say, well, let's pretend this was a tort. Let's approach it as if it were a tort, and we're good at awarding damages in tort, so we'll approach it like that. Another approach would be to say, let us try and work out what damages Strasbourg would have given if this case had been brought in Strasbourg. Now, some of the earlier cases treated this took the tort-like approach. But then in a case called Greenfield, the House of Lords said, no, we should be seeking to achieve what would be the position as if this was in Strasbourg. And Lord Bingham quite famously said, the Human Rights Act is not a tort statute. Mm-hmm. This is about bringing rights home. And so we should be trying to do what Strasbourg would do. That has led to, I'm not criticising that decision, I can see the sense of it, but it has led to some difficulties, including that Strasbourg case law on damages, it's difficult to find much by way of principle from them. So in the book on human rights, actually, in when we think about remedies and damages, quite a lot of what we do is to set out lots of examples of previous damages awards, which theoretically isn't very satisfying. You know, we want to, what's the principle, you know, scholars and students, what's the principle to guide us? Just sort of trying to fit in, say that it's quite like a previous case which awarded a certain amount of money is less satisfying. But as I say, the book is ultimately to be useful for practitioners, and so we try and build up a picture of what damages have been awarded. One principle which has been observed through an empirical study of the cases, so not so much focusing on what the Strasbourg court says it's doing, but looking at what it is actually awarding, has been carried out by the scholar Professor Veronica Fickfack, and she says, contrary to what you might expect, the focus in terms of how much you get in terms of damages for non-pecuniary damages, stuff which isn't related to a specific bill you've had to pay as a result of the breach. For these non-pecuniary damages, the focus seems to be less upon the individual claimant and more about the position of the state in relation to human rights breaches. So it's not possible to build up a picture with any complete certainty. You have to look at the cases and how they've been resolved. But a focus on the state, says Fickfack, is important in terms of understanding what's going on.
What exactly does that mean when you say focus on the state? Like economically, politically?
So it would include things such as the financial position in the state. And that makes sense, that the value of euros are different in different countries because of cost of living, etc. But also it might relate to how often that state has breached that particular right. And if a state is a frequent breach of a particular right, that might lead to higher damages, or sometimes in relation to certain rights, lower damages.
Yeah.
And these are things which are independent of the facts of the applicant's particular case, but they can be relevant, this research suggests, in terms of the setting of the quantum, the setting of the level of an award of damage.
And do you think this approach towards damages, the kind of piecemeal approach, has been effective in practice? Is this something that the court should look to change and kind of steer in a different direction?
Well, in terms of effectiveness, at the end of the day, the courts do award damages, and so to an extent it achieves its aim. There are two problems with it. One is predictability, and the other is workload, in that, in terms of predictability, it can be very difficult to advise a client in terms of if you're going to get damages, and if so, how much they would be. Mm-hmm. And that's not ideal. You know, we would want to a legal system to provide a decent amount of certainty as to what the end result of litigation might be. So that's one thing which is possibly less than ideal. And another thing which is less than ideal is how time consuming it can be, this approach of trying to work out what Strasbourg would award. And the approach which we've taken in the book of saying, well, you know, this is this is what was awarded in previous cases, etc., can lead to the citation of loads of cases in court to try and give the court a picture of what previously has been awarded. And a case called Sternum and Faulkner against the Parole Board more than 10 years ago now, the Supreme Court referred to the citation of a blizzard of authorities and saying, well, if you're going to have loads of cases, you have to set them out on a table, which sort of, really paints a picture. This is time consuming, not only for the court, but also for the lawyers, you know, making sure that they are citing enough cases to build up this picture. Mm. And obviously, the more workload there is for lawyers, the more expensive proceedings are. So that is a downside of taking this approach.
Yeah. So it seems to be kind of more a data-driven approach than one based on principles. Would you say that's an accurate picture?
So, yes, I think so. I mean, I wouldn't say there are no principles at all. One can see some principles in the case law, but you are, I would have thought, as a claimant or an applicant, you're going to want to refer to a number of previous cases to locate where you should be in a damages claim, which, I think describing it as a data-driven approach is a nice way of putting it.
Turning now to common law rights, could you tell me a little bit about how these protections fell into disuse after the 2000s and what led to the resurgence in the 2010s, especially in cases like Osborne and Parole Board, Kennedy and Information Commission, ANBBC?
Thank you. I think in thinking about this question, I think a little bit about the first Toy Story film. This came out when I was a child, so it'll be way before your time. But in Toy Story starts with Woody, and he's very much the leader of the toys. But then it's the child Andy's birthday, and Andy gets a new Buzz Lightyear toy.
Yeah.
And this is very disruptive because Woody sort of gets sidelined a bit, and Buzz Lightyear gets all of the attention, and also he doesn't realise he's a toy. But that's not quite the point I'm making. But it's a bit like that when the Human Rights Act first came in, Woody was still there. The common law was still there, mm-hmm. but the judges had a new toy. The judges had the Human Rights Act. The judges had, the intellectual equivalent of Buzz Lightyear. You know, they needed to work out how this device worked and what its significance was, you know. The same way, if you push this button on Buzz Lightyear, he flashes his laser. If you push that button, his wings come out. You know, what did the human rights do? What can be expected? And that was partly why there was so much litigation, because they were working out, you know, what does Section 3 do? Mm-hmm. What are the limits of Section 6, for instance? And that's why one of the main drivers of the litigation is uncertainty. And obviously, there was uncertainty at first as to precisely how the Human Rights Act worked. So part of the reason we might say that we saw more reference to common law after 10 years or so of the use of the Human Rights Act is that there needed to be less litigation on the Human Rights Act because those uncertainties had been more or less resolved for the most part in terms of what the Human Rights Act was doing. But I think your question gets at slightly more than that, which is that there was a seeming preference on some part of the judges to use common law arguments rather than Human Rights Act arguments. Now, why might this have been so? Potentially, because Strasbourg was not necessarily always answering the questions as precisely as the UK courts might have wanted. Also, it is easier to take authority which is closer to the context in which you're trying to apply it. Mm-hmm. Strasbourg cases come from all over Europe, and so the reasoning and the factual position might be less closely applicable to a situation in the UK than would be the position for a domestic authority. You know, the facts might just be closer and therefore easier to apply. And another point, which is similar to what we were thinking about in terms of damages, there are loads of Strasbourg cases, and it can be difficult to navigate in terms of what case you should be looking at. Dr. Stefan Teil at the law faculty, he did a load of research in which was suggesting, actually, you need to approach Strasbourg case law as data in order to understand it. And that's something which is very difficult for lawyers to do. So being able to go back to home turf and use common law cases is probably quite helpful in that regard. There's also potentially a sense of national pride in what has a claim to be one of the great legal systems of the world. You know, the common law system is has a number of good aspects to it. And, you know, once the judges had got used to using the Human Rights Act, there could be recognition that actually many of these questions or many of these claims could be resolved via our established tools.
Mm-hmm. Right. And more recently, though, there's been a move away from that approach. So you've seen this in cases like El Ghazouli, Ellen Kane and AAA Syria. Courts are increasingly deferential, granting their decisions in statutes rather than expanding common law rights. Do you think this marks the end of the kind of common law revival, or does it just reflect that we've accepted the limits of it and this is just now where it is in the law?
Yeah, I think there are many different ways of answering that sort of question. Dr. Lewis Graham, who is a lecturer in human rights at Manchester, would say that actually a lot of this comes down to personalities. So these really big cases are decided by a very small group of people, the Supreme Court, and who is on the Supreme Court and who is making those decisions makes a big difference. He suggests that when Lord Reed became the president of the Supreme Court in succession to Lady Hale, that led to a major change in terms of the court's approach to the government and in relation to human rights issues, that essentially the personnel were more conservative. I'm not 100% sure that I would say that all of those cases necessarily reflect a major downgrading in the common law approach. I mean, I think quite a lot of those cases are, you know, relates to the use of the Human Rights Act. Ellen Kane, for instance, a large part of that is about the margin of appreciation rather than so much the common law. And in terms of personnel, it's worth remembering that Lord Reed decided the Unison case, which is, you know, has a decent claim to be one of the most assertive common law protection cases of the last decade or so. So to give an irritating answer, I think it's a bit of a case of wait and see, and also how the pendulum swings. It might also depend to an extent on what happens, if anything, to the Human Rights Act. So I certainly wouldn't be saying that common law rights or common law approach to protections rather are dead or no longer relevant. But as with so much in public law, there may be fashions which shift somewhat over time.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking a little bit about the kind of idea of the pendulum swing and how things change over time. The ECHR has become a major political talking point again. The Conservative Party under Kemi Badenoch has said that if it wins the next election, it would take the UK out of the convention. Reform UK has been even more explicit about withdrawal. And within Labour, a few MPs have suggested that no option should be off the table. Critics say that these calls overstate how much the ECHR actually affects immigration decisions, but they've clearly struck a chord with parts of the public. With two major UK political parties publicly stating they would consider withdrawing from the ECHR, how do you think the view of rights protection in the UK, especially given how deeply the convention has become embedded in the legal system, is going to change?
Yeah, well, to give a classic irritating lawyer answer, you know, that is essentially a political question rather than a legal question. It may well depend on who wins the next election. That said, I suspect it will be difficult to go back wholesale on the idea of rights as part of the relationship between individuals and the state. Mm-hmm. One of the major consequences or achievements, I would say, of the Human Rights Act is that it is one of the major ways in which we think about our relationship with the state is that we have rights in relation to the state. Mm-hmm. And that's something which wasn't nearly so obvious 30 years ago. I think that will be difficult to row back on. And it is interesting that Dominic Raab's proposal for reform of the Human Rights or replacement of the Human Rights Act was for replacement with something else.
Yeah.
And so I would suggest it would might be relatively unlikely that we would just scrap the Human Rights Act and have nothing in terms of rights protection at all. I think it would be much more likely that we would have some sort of domestic set of rights, probably seeking to be more limited and with more carve-outs in terms of some people not having protection, you know, as full levels of protection, particularly migrants. Now, the extent to which that this actually fits with the idea of human rights, which is that we have human rights whoever we are, and these are things which are inherent in us as humans, might be doubtful. But I think we'd be more likely to see some rights protection, but possibly on a more piecemeal basis and possibly on a less sort of blanket basis than we currently have under the UCHR and the Human Rights Act.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think that means for you as a practitioner? What's the approach going to be given the new attitudes towards the ECHR and the HRA?
Yeah, I mean, I'm flattered by the description of me as a practitioner. I haven't taken a case in years. But for, you know, my erstwhile colleagues in chambers and other public law practitioners, what would this mean? I think the big questions, if there were repeal of the Human Rights Act, would be twofold. Firstly, in how would the courts interpret and approach its replacement?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, what to do with common law constitutional rights. So in terms of the first point, remember it took about 10 years. I was suggesting it took quite a while for the courts to get used to the use of the Human Rights Act, you know, using Buzz Lightyear. How long would it take them to get used to its replacement? And also, the courts can be quite potent in terms of their approach to public law questions when they think that is important. So might one see a combination of a Bill of Rights which is arguably more limited by the Human Rights Act, but then something of the spirit of Anna's Minnick and Privacy International entering into the way in which the courts actually approach that and start applying that? That is a possibility. Another possibility is that one might see something of a resurgence in the use of common law constitutional rights, kind of to make up what might be seen as a gap following the repeal of the Human Rights Act and leaving the convention. All of these things would lead to uncertainty, and uncertainty leads to litigation. So I think the in terms of the effect on practitioners is that it would lead to
more work,
to it being an extremely busy time, and also a very difficult time in terms of advising one's clients, both claimant and public authority, in terms of what they have to be doing.
Do you think, having implemented the HRA about now 25 years ago, have we learned anything about what it's like for practitioners when a new Bill of Rights come into play? And is there anything we can learn from the implementation of the HRA when dealing with, if there is to be, a prospective Bill of Rights?
Yeah. So on that, I confess, I was not even nearly in practice when the Human Rights Act came into force. But what one thing which was interesting and important is that the government gave quite a long time for between the passing of the Human Rights Act and its entry into force. So it was about 2 years.
Yeah.
And that, I think, would be well advised if we were to have a major change to domestic human rights law, that actually lawyers have time to get their heads around how they think it might work,
mm-hmm.
to essentially to workshop possibilities in terms of where the law might end up, but also critically engagement with the public sector. So the government engaged in lots of training in advance of the entry into force of the act, to help make sure that the decision makers who are subject to the act have some sense of how it works. I think that would be absolutely vital too.
Kind of wrapping things up,
Why
do you think the ECHR has become such a lightning rod in British politics again, and particularly around immigration?
Mm-hmm.
And do you think this is because the convention itself has kind of shifted in meaning because of the living instrument doctrine, or have domestic politics shifted in how it's being perceived?
So the first answer I would give in relation to the lightning rod point, which is a striking way of putting it, is blame. and the attractiveness of blame over the decades in politics, in democratic politics, the attractiveness of being able to blame someone or something else. And I don't want to be overly political, but one way of viewing what is going on is that, you know, the political right, especially the Conservative Party, can use the European Convention as an explanation for them not accomplishing what they might have wanted to accomplish in 14 years of power, firstly in coalition and then subsequently without. But there was a Conservative Prime Minister for 14 years, and yet the country is not necessarily in the position which we would want it to be in a number of ways. So as an opposition, how do they deal with that fact? One of the main ways is to say, well, we were subject to a foreign power. There was there were things we could not address. So a sense of sort of othering and saying, well, you know, this was foreign judges imposing foreign laws on us, rather than essentially engaging with what are very difficult questions. In terms of whether this is partly the fault or the responsibility or the consequence of the Living Tree Doctrine, well, it is maybe partly the consequence of the Living Tree Doctrine, but whether that is something which can be viewed as fault depends on whether you think that the interpretations of rights which the court has reached are sustainable or not. Mm-hmm. And the view I've reached, you know, as someone who practiced to an extent in immigration law and also as an administrative law scholar, is it's actually very difficult to win as a claimant on human rights grounds for a migrant, particularly if they're a criminal. Now, the number of cases which succeed are absolutely tiny. Of these sort of ones which the press would describe as highly egregious. And there's also an issue of sort of media responsibility here, that it's very easy for the media to report that someone who has done something objectively awful is relying on human rights to seek to, you know, get away with it in some way or another. But you'll note what I said there. That is that person seeking to rely on rights to get away with it.
Yeah.
So a lot of newspaper headlines, if you dig beneath the surface, are saying that somebody has made a claim based on human rights, not that that claim has been successful. So that muddies the narrative, that people are saying, well, human rights are going too far. Well, people are raising that could be rewritten as people are raising spurious human rights arguments which then fail. I mean, people raise spurious arguments in court all the time, but that doesn't mean it has to hit the national news. And so that is also partly an issue, that there's maybe not as much awareness as they could of how many of these arguments actually succeed, as opposed to just simply being raised.
It's interesting then, because as mentioned, the ECHR was drafted mainly by English lawyers. So it's just interesting now that we've come away
including
from
that. Including a Conservative Chancellor.
Yeah.
Lord Chancellor Vicomte Kilmeade, as he became. The Conservative Party doesn't talk about that at all.
No, not something you hear very much about. It's like they're trying to banish that kind of past of theirs. Yeah, it's interesting that the same party is now the one that's really driving the force between keeping it and repealing it. Hmm. What do you think that says about, I don't know, kind of the current politics at the moment, if you want to speak about that?
Well, there's maybe two things. Firstly, the ability to blame.
Yeah.
And secondly, the almost a sort of tit for tat trying to outdo other people. So there were, you know, start off with, okay, we need to tinker with the Human Rights Act. We need to replace the Human Rights Act with a British Bill of Rights. That didn't work because that was Dominic Raab's project and he left. This isn't working, so we need to leave the European Convention. And this is all the Conservative Party in dialogue with itself, but also in dialogue with other right-wing politics, you know, especially what's become reform, that you almost, you don't want to be left behind in your criticism of human rights, because, yeah. You know, if you're the person who's saying, actually, I think that human rights is okay, you end up seeming liberal and weak, and you're not doing anything to resolve the problems which are affecting the country. Yeah. So there's almost a sort of race to the top in terms of criticism of human rights. So I think that's a major part of it, and the Conservatives' perceived vulnerability to the Reform Party. They don't want to be seen to be doing insufficient in terms of dealing with, you know, foreign interference in our law. It's reached the stage that Robert Jenrick, who's the Shadow Secretary of State for Justice, has turned his attention not just to the European Convention on Human Rights, but the Aarhus Convention on access to information and environmental justice. You know, that is interfering with our law. Again, this seems slightly like an attempt to be the person or the party which is bravest and boldest in terms of taking on foreign and external influence, which prevents us doing what we need to do for the good of the country. I think that is part of the picture.
Mm.
Other viewpoints are available, of course.
Yeah.
And one might say there are legitimate criticisms of particularly some of the decisions of the European Court. I suppose the difficulty is to say that we need to have a balanced picture of these things.
Yeah.
You know, there are domestic court cases with which we might disagree, but that doesn't mean we should abolish the court system. The problem is, particularly in the era of social media, the argument you have to read a lot of data and the position is very subtle and nuanced,
yeah,
doesn't really win online spats.
No.
And it doesn't project well in terms of a political picture. A lot of politics is done now in three-word slogans. And the book we've just published is at 1,300 pages long.
Yeah.
You know, so getting an
not
accurate
a good Twitter headline.
Yeah. I mean, you're getting an accurate picture of what human rights is and does and how it's achieved is a difficult message to get across in this era.
Yeah. All right, that feels like a good place to end this off. Thank you so much for coming to speak to me today. I hope that was fulfilling, and I hope you got to talk about the work you do a little bit more.
Oh, well, thank you much. I've very much enjoyed it, and thank you for your interesting questions, and thank you for your time.
So that was my conversation with Alistair. I hope you all enjoyed that and that it was informative in some ways. Human rights is something that you come to eventually in the constitutional law course, and it's even a paper in second year or third year for those of you that are currently doing it. I hope it touches on some exciting and relevant topics at the moment, and that we've been able to shed some light on the future of the HRA in this quite politically uncertain time. Thank you so much for listening. And as said, if you have anything that you'd really like to hear me speak about or anyone you'd like me to speak to, do reach out to us on Instagram and I'll try my best to make that happen for you. I hope everyone's doing all right. And yeah, that's it from me. All right, signing off. Bye bye, guys.